Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Alex Weiss, our man in Germany, who is the real brains behind the Daily French Show. Alex, very good to see you here. Welcome back to the show. It's been a while.
No, thanks, Nick. It's great to be on. Step up from behind the scenes. Obviously, standing in for dear colleague Tiecho, who's dealing with some family-related personal issues. So, wish him all the best.
No, indeed. I echo all of that. And of course, our supreme high poobah himself, CEO of the Institute of Race Relations, Dr. John Endres. John, very good to see you.
Good to see you as well, Nicholas. And I'm looking forward to having my business cards printed with that title, poobah. I think that works.
I'm very fond of that, actually, as a title. I think more things should be called the Grand High Poobah. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So first, just a word from our sponsor. We are once again this week sponsored by Bitvice. So here's some words from them. Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitcoin believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. They don't hold your keys. They don't hold your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. And we thank them very much for sponsoring us. Right. So let us get started with the story today. So this is actually one that comes out last week. Our colleague Gabriel was talking to me, briefing me a little bit about it before the show. And there are some pretty disturbing implications from this court case. So let me lay it out as best as I can. And please, gentlemen, correct me if I make any mistakes. But essentially, there was a land invasion in progress on a piece of land that belonged to the city of Cape Town. Some people were setting up shacks on this land, and as the setting up was going on, the city arrived to begin removing the people who had set up the shacks there. There was a particular man, Bulelani Kolani, there are two different versions of the story. His version is that he was washing when the city broke down his door and dragged him naked from his shack. And this was filmed and kind of went a bit viral. The city's version was that when he saw them coming, he took off his clothes to create a bit of a spectacle and held up his ID outside, waving it around, saying, "You can't evict me. I'm legal," or something like that. Anyway, this went before the court. I believe the city's version was corroborated by some testimony. His version was not, but it was ruled initially that the city was not within its rights to remove him from this property because of COVID and the moratorium on evictions. However, the court came back once the state of disaster and everything was lifted to once again look at the issue and say, okay, outside of COVID, did the city have the right to evict this guy? And the court ruled that no, it did not. There is basically sort of two stages of when squatters enter a property or a house. There's an initial stage with a fancy technical term, which I can't quite remember now, where basically as the invasion is happening, the police can remove you without a court order. However, once you're established in a property, you need a court order in order to evict someone, and that is very expensive. It can cost more than 800,000 rand. It can take minimum of 10 months, but sometimes many years, especially if the application is opposed, as it often is in cases like this. And basically, it becomes cost prohibitive because at that point, the owner of the property is responsible for its rates, taxes, and utilities, even though they didn't give permission to the person who's staying there to stay there. So the court said, yes, the city does have the right to remove people while they are setting up. However, in this case, what counts as setting up was disputed. And the city found that once you've begun constructing your shelters, in this case, let's say you've put up a shack wall, or if you have put up your taken off your clothes at some point, that it is considered you to have to be living there. And effectively, at that point, you need a court order. So the city said, in this case, the court said, in this case, the city required a court order to evict these people. It couldn't simply do it with normal police powers. So the consequences of this could be quite far-reaching. John, let's start with you. What do you make of this case?
All of this sounds quite technical. And I think the term you're looking for there was counter-spoliation. And counter-spoliation is like the idea that, you know, if somebody takes something from you, somebody steals something from you, are you allowed to steal it back effectively? And the law says, yeah, you know, if somebody steals your watch and you run after the thief and you catch them and you take your watch back, that's fine. And in this case, what was being stolen was effectively land that belonged to somebody else, which is the city of Cape Town, that somebody built a shack on and claimed ownership over. The city disputed that by removing that person and invoking this idea of counter-spoliation and saying, this guy stole our land, we're stealing it back, and we should be fine because, you know, the law allows for that. But what has happened now is that the way the court has ruled on this matter really should freak you out, because effectively it has come within a hair's breadth of legalizing the theft of land. It is a very, very significant ruling. You know, it sets a precedent for other eviction cases and land grab cases, and it really strengthens the hand of those involved in illegal land grabs. It is a extremely concerning ruling. I really can't emphasize enough how bad it is. It fits into sort of a broader area of our concerns at the IRR, which is about property rights in South Africa. And traditionally, you know, there were always four things that we would list that concern us. The first, obviously, was expropriation without compensation. The second was prescribed assets, where the government will, you know, tell pension funds how much of their money they have to invest in Eskom or SAA, for example. The third one was the NHI, which is like the nationalization of the private health system. The fourth was the nationalization of the Reserve Bank. And most of these things are sort of, you know, either grinding to a halt or not really progressing, but still on the policy card somewhere on the party, on the ANC's program, and therefore still a risk to investment and to, you know, the development and progress of South Africa as a society. But we now have to add this fifth entry, because what this judgment means is that somebody can enter into your home while you are on holiday, make themselves comfortable, get undressed, and there's no way of evicting them. You can't get the police to get them out. You're going to need a court order to get them out. And that is going to take, as you said, you know, 10 months if you're lucky, and hundreds of thousands of rands worth of expenses on your side, and longer if you're unlucky. It's a completely insane state of affairs. And, you know, just to reiterate what you were saying earlier, while your property is being occupied, you remain liable for rates and taxes on that property. In the case of Johannesburg, in the inner city, you know, there'd be sort of tall buildings that somebody owned. Get the invaders in. You remain liable for the rates and taxes, which keep accumulating over time, over a question of years maybe, until they reach a point where you owe the city more than the building is worth. And that is where people then start abandoning their building and saying, what's the point? You know, I now owe more money on this building than it is worth. Keep it. And the destruction of value is immeasurable. My colleague Gabriel Krauser, I also spoke to him just before the show, did a back-of-the-envelope calculation and reckons that just the inner city of Johannesburg itself suffered a loss in value of R1 trillion in asset value. And that's just one CBD. It's completely insane. This is also based on a law called the Prevention of Illegal Eviction Law, which protects the rights of people illegally invading a property, for example, and makes it very onerous for the lawful owner to reassume control of their property. So this is a fine example of how socialist policies destroy value. And that is really what we're facing at the moment in South Africa. I'm going to leave it for there for now. Nicholas, back to you.
Yeah, so you can also envisage a situation here where you kind of have spiraling into anarchy. So with the court system slow and not really working, with effectively the loss of property from for that, that's very easy to happen. It's very easy for gangs to sort of set themselves up, oppose the court applications, install people in other people's property and collect rent, as happened in the Joburg CBD, and does happen all over the country, still to this day. And what's the next response? Well, if you're a property owner and this is really important to you, maybe you decide, well, the legal system's not working for me, so I'm going to hire some heavy guys to come around and chase people off. And then next thing you know, the gang that's that organized the people to go there in the first place is arming themselves. And then you have street battles between, you know, private heavies on behalf of the property owner and criminal gangs, which are invading these properties. And that's not exactly a recipe for happiness. Am I being hysterical, Alex? What do you make of all this?
At what stage do we rename the country the Wild West? I think what is so, it's so scary. And I think like the Dominic Stain, article, which you shared with us before the show, which is in Business Day, in that article, it's highlighted how there are crime syndicates that go around and do this kind of thing. Obviously, the court case in question wasn't necessarily about a syndicate, but in a state where we don't, as you mentioned, you've got that little window where you can evict the trespassers effectively. But we know the capability of our national police force. And this whole thing just kind of ties into, as John mentioned, all these subsidiary sort of national socialist policies of the ANC, again, speaks to how it just undermines a capable state. And it is going to be everyone fighting for themselves. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's not only is property rights completely flipped on its head, but I mean, I've had the pleasure of running through the streets of downtown Johannesburg. And, you know, if the rest of the city starts experiencing that kind of land invasion and deterioration as a result, it's going to drive down property rights absolutely everywhere. And I think that, you know, that's just one ramification. And it's pretty scary. And I think it's very disheartening to see how these syndicates can be weaponized. And I think it's something for me that what's concerning is in the context of things like the conversation about expropriation without compensation, and with the ANC gradually losing power, and, you know, heading towards 2024, you know, we still don't know what happened with the riots. Is this a new form of weaponry as the ANC begins its descent into... Well,
the EFF has openly called for people to invade land. Specifically hoping to inflict stuff like this. So I see someone in the comments mentioned the South African movie Jerusalem. I think the full title is Gangster's Paradise Jerusalem. I would also highly recommend it. It's about a building hijacker and he's a fictional character, but it's a very realistic story in Johannesburg. Great film, great South African film. Do check it out if you can. So John, let me just very briefly play the devil's advocate here. And on this, I'm pulling from the people who defended Mr. Bululani Gwalani, in this case, the Legal Resources Center. You know, we have a constitutional right to housing. What's the negative consequence really if some wealthy property owners have to, you know, bear some extra costs to house poor people? Is that really such a massive crime?
Well, so we've got Section 25 of the Constitution, which protects property rights, and we've got Section 26 of the Constitution that guarantees the access to housing or access to housing. It doesn't guarantee housing, it guarantees access to housing. This is one of the so-called progressive rights in the Constitution, which means that it can be progressively fulfilled, but it is the government's responsibility to fulfill that right within the scope and limits of its means. So this means if the government wants to make available housing to every single person in South Africa, it should do so. The Constitution says it must. But if it hasn't got the money to do so, then it has to wait until it's got the money. What it does not say is that private property owners are responsible for realizing the right to access to housing for every single South African, which is a completely mad idea. You know, I'm only sputtering here. I can't even express how crazy that is. And even... You know, extrapolating the idea to the public infrastructure, you know, consider the country's railway networks. So on any part of the railway network, somebody can now erect a shack and say, I'm going to stay here. This is now my home. no more trains can pass through until that person gets removed from the tracks, which can be a question of years. And, you know, at the same time, the railways also can't secure the entire railway network because it's too long. They can't have eyes on all of it at the same time. So they can't move fast enough to move in compliance with this court order and remove somebody, you know, before they've erected a single wall of their house or had time to take off their clothing while they're in that shack. So, yeah, this is really, really insane.
Very concerning stuff. So obviously we're going to be keeping an eye on that. Let's move on to our next point of discussion. And this is, we had another, what has been very annoyingly nicknamed, family meetings last night, where President Ramaphosa spoke to the nation about addressing the country's energy crisis. And he announced a couple of measures, which I think there might be much to say about, with regards to fixing Eskom. So I think the big one was a complete scrapping of licensing requirements for private energy projects. So until last year, sort of halfway through last year, you needed a special license in order to generate more than 1 megawatt of power. That cap was then lifted to 100 megawatts, which led to a bunch of projects coming online. That cap of 100 megawatts has now been scrapped, so you don't require a special license to generate more than that for the grid. Eskom says it will start to buy electricity from independent power producers in order to boost its supply. It will also import power from Botswana and Zambia, and it will take a pragmatic approach in regarding some of the regulations. There are a bunch of other ones. It's also going to get an increase in its budget, specifically for a focus on maintenance. And Eskom will also be constructing some solar and battery projects. And perhaps least impressively, a National Energy Crisis Committee, which is chaired by the Director General and the Presidency, will be set up. Ramaphosa said, after years of state capture and mismanagement, our capable and effective management team is working hard to turn the utility around and reverse years of decay. Eskom is too big to fail. It is a national asset, but it will coexist with private players. Alex, let me start with you. This, to me, seems like at least some positive steps. Definitely not everything that we'd want to see in reforming Eskom, but at least some useful additions here to the policy mix.
What do you mean? No, absolutely. I think what this in part reveals on a positive note is that pressure does work. But I think when things do really start crippling and crawling on their knees, or I think Eskom's probably groveling at the moment, then the government is forced to act, which I think is what you're seeing here. But fortunately, there are some good things here. And I think people have been shouting from the rooftops where they have installed their solar panels to privatize, open the market, let people produce their own power. And unfortunately, you know, we are seeing some moves in the right direction. So at least there is some positive gain here, but the president could have gone a lot further. We know there's been issues with skilled staff being retrenched or taking voluntary sort of severance packages. There's a massive skills deficit that hasn't gone anywhere, but at least the public can now actually contribute on a much greater scale to solve the problem that largely occurred under President Ramaphosa's watch. But let's hope there's a light at the end of this tunnel.
John, what do you make of these policy changes?
I think it is striking that how many of these echo what has been called for by business, by energy experts, by the opposition parties, and the fact that those proposals have been taken on board is encouraging. The proof of the pudding is going to be in the eating, however. So it's really going to be a question of how quickly and how seriously these reforms are implemented. If they are, we're probably still looking at another 2 to 3 years of load shedding because it takes time for new generating capacity to come on board and the networks to be built for all of that capacity to be distributed. But still, you have to start somewhere, and it's better to start today than to start tomorrow. However, you know, some questions that we can still raise is, for example, that the president said he wanted to ease local content requirements, but it's not clear to what extent he wants to do that. Whether it's going to be market-based or whether it will still be designed to suit crony interests. Then there's the regulations about allowing users to sell power back to the grid. But again, that's going to be subject to regulations. And is that going to be slow or fast? And will anybody be able to do that, or only people with political connections? Then you've got the race-based procurement policies, for example, which is one of the things we've been calling for that to be exempted, for ESCOM to be exempted from those requirements. But at the same time, that is not something that has been directly addressed by the president. So I think there's a lot of good in there, but it remains to be seen whether it really is implemented, executed, and then does lead to the improvements which the country so desperately needs in the energy sector.
Just on that point of the proof being in the eating, I'll give an example of how the Minister of Mineral Resources was asked a while ago, do you need to be BEE compliant to prospect for minerals? He said no. The department said yes. There was complaints. The minister said, oh, well, the department is wrong. I'll make sure that's changed. And as far as I know, even though the rules are supposed to that you don't have to be BEE compliant, in practice, the department still won't accept you unless you do that. So simply declaring the regulations have changed is not always, you know, our bureaucracy is so frozen in place, so filled with inertia, that it's that there actually needs to be a lot of effort behind it to get it to change. It doesn't just simply listen to commands. So, yeah, very good, I think, to keep an eye out on exactly what is done. All right, let's move on to our last story for today. And this is a great little story from Limpopo. There's a village called Vondo. This is a story reported on by Ground Up, which is near Toyanduyo. And this village is not exactly in the center of the hustle and bustle of South Africa. It's a very poor area. It's off a main road. It doesn't have great infrastructure leading to it. Well, part of the problem there is that the people in the village need to walk across their bridge. They need to walk across a river to get to school sometimes. It's difficult to get into the village because the road is badly damaged. And after years and years and years of asking the municipality to please build them a footbridge over the river, to please fix some of the roads that it would be easier to get into the village, the villagers had enough and they've decided to raise the money themselves and get about fixing it themselves. So far they've raised 135,000 rand, but estimate that they need another 70,000. Of the 900 houses, they extracted at least 150 from every single house there. And they have set to work building a footbridge across the local river to make it safer for children to cross going to school, which is a very big deal. In 2020, a student actually drowned crossing that river during the rainy season. And they are working to fix the road, to pour some concrete and such. However, it's not all sunshine and roses. The villagers themselves admit that they don't really have expertise and they're kind of figuring out the construction project as they go along. They're going to do the best they can with what they have. But they said also the spokesperson for the local chief said, we no longer trust the municipality as it does not fulfill its promises. John, what do you make of this story? I think it's quite interesting because it shows that, as per our theme from yesterday, that South Africans often do make a plan when things are difficult.
So there's a kind of silver lining story, and I think I do appreciate it for that. But it also reminds me how screwed poor South Africans are compared to middle-class South Africans. Much of the race-based preferential policy in South Africa is really geared towards people who are middle-class or better off, or tycoons, as the Black Industrialist Program is meant to create. But the vast majority of South Africans are really stuck, like the villages of Vondo, with bad infrastructure, not really being able to access the town easily, and with a completely unresponsive government, that doesn't really come to the party at all. So if you're middle class or better, you're going to be buying private services all over the place, education, health, security, et cetera, et cetera. If you're poor, you haven't got that option, and you're stuck with what the government delivers to you. And if that is crap, then that is what you stick with. And it is encouraging to see these villagers now refusing to take it any longer and saying, nothing good is going to come from government, unfortunately, in this case. We've given you 20 years to build a simple footbridge. You haven't managed to do that. We're going to do it ourselves. We don't know how to do it. We don't know, where to get the money, but we're going to do it ourselves. We'll find the money. we're going to simply go ahead and get it done. And that is a good spirit, I think, to have on the part of South Africans. But really, it shouldn't have come to this. Nicholas.
Alex, what do you make of this?
Yeah, it's the idea of a stockfall is not foreign to any South African, and it's kind of employing the same technique here. The silver lining for me is certainly to see that communities are taking things into their own hand. It's very discouraging that trust in municipalities is understandably at such low levels. But there was actually a story, the story made me reflect on another one that came across in Biz News, and I'll try and share the link for show notes afterwards. But it was about a businessman in the Western Cape who was developing mountain bike trails in the Cape Winelands area. And he realized that the trails were being used by locals for commuting. And so they created a whole net, they doubled up the network to allow for the community to move between areas like Kyle Moore and Neil and those kind of areas. And so maybe the solution here is to establish a massive mountain biking network in Toyandru. If you can tolerate the heat, maybe there's some merit there. But I think that's the kind of thing where you have such a great synergy between private sector and locals coming together. I know in that case, there were a lot of skills development. They had rangers to police the trails and that kind of stuff. And it's good to know that while everything seems to be crumbling and municipalities are more and more becoming unreliable, that there are solutions. But I think the one thing is that really has to come into the equation leading up to 2024 is the reestablishing of a capable state and building trust in public institutions so that we don't have to go into the shadows and do things all ourselves, as great as that initiative is.
Right. And, you know, with the government failures, I mean, you know, we have a lot of rules and regulations put in place. So you can imagine government getting in the way here by saying, your footbridge isn't up to standard. And it's possible it might not be up to standard. But then we're kind of left with a sort of dilemma here of, you know, what's better? No footbridge and people drowning in the river, or a footbridge that might not be up to standard. Maybe it's safe. Maybe it's not. I don't know. And I think there's definitely going to have to be a reevaluation in government, because while state capacity is rebuilt after reforms happen, that's going to take a while. And in the meantime, I think, you know, the private sector, as you guys say, there's scope for it to do a lot of good stuff. And government's going to have to work out how to deal with that, how to make sure that, you know, it doesn't create bigger problems, but at the same time, that it doesn't get in the way and stifle out any innovation, creativity, or problem solving that South Africans have shown themselves very capable of doing. John, your thoughts on that point, and any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, maybe just like a sort of closing thought on this, as a quote from William Gibson, the science fiction author, who said that the future is not equally distributed. And the kind of point he was making is that in some areas of the world, it already seems like people are living in the future. In other places, people aren't. They haven't arrived there yet, but they will eventually. But what we're seeing here in South Africa, you know, even though the idea might be that these villages are living in the past, sort of being left behind, in a way they are living in the future, because they are moving ahead with getting things done by themselves. And increasingly, it looks like that is the direction in which South Africa is going as a country. So maybe this is a view of the future. You know, you need to, if you want something to be done, you have to do it. You can't wait for the government to do it.
Indeed so. So we don't really have time to discuss this last story, but I think it's something to keep an eye on. And that is that the famous Nhlanhla Lux, which is not his real name, it's his public persona name, has said that him and his organization, the Soweto Parliament, is cutting ties with Operation Dudula. Apparently, the two organizations, his and Operation Dudula, came into disagreement with each other because Operation Dudula believes that all foreigners, regardless of legal status, should be removed from the country. Whereas Nhlanhla Lux Dlamini says that it should only be those who are illegal. And the two groups have decided in a joint statement that there was no way forward to resolve this issue and that they will continue to deal with the problem of illegal immigration, or immigration, I guess, in Operation Dudula's situation, under their own brands with different approaches. And they seem to have declared that they had an amicable divorce. A bit weird. We don't really have time to go into it today. But anyway, keep an eye on that in the news, because I'm sure we haven't heard the last from Mr. Dlamini. All right. Thank you very much for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the show, found it interesting. We will see you next week. I will put some links to some of the stories we've been talking about, particularly on our first issue, in the pinned comment section on YouTube. And with that, I hope you all have a wonderful day, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.